HealthMD.com. It's your life, your health, it's your show. You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, starring Dr. Michael Royson, MD.
And this is Dr. Mike. You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, and we have a great guest for you. As I've said, John Markoff has been in Silicon Valley reporting for the New York Times for 27 years. He says his website to read his blog is really www.newyorktimes.com. So you can find it there. He is the reporter who's lived through this. He and I were talking, reminiscing about our common times in San Francisco. He grew up in Palo Alto, so he's lived there most of his life, in the Bay Area anyway. And one of the, I forgot to tell him that I still have my original VisiCalc that I used. I think it was on an Apple IIe, because he's seen all the development. I've used the technology, but haven't witnessed one of the real points he makes in this book, Machines of Loving Grace, The Quest for Common Ground Between Humans and Robots. And in it, he makes the point that it is the values of the companies that are developing whether we will go through AI, artificial intelligence, where humans will be replaced or maybe controlled by machines, versus IA, intellectual augmentation, where humans will use machines to grab us and help propel us further. So, first of all, I've got to ask, John, how did you get, there's so much in this book, but how did you get first interested in this whole field? What grabbed you initially?
Well, I've reported about AI, the AI field, artificial intelligence field, for a long, long time, but I think there were sort of two reasons that sort of converged. One is that in 2004, DARPA started having these events they called Grand Challenges, and the first one was the Autonomous Vehicle Grand Challenge, and I began covering those, and they were a lot more fun than the other thing that I was writing about at that time, which was cybersecurity, and cybersecurity just got worse and worse and worse, and I was writing the same story over and over and over again, and finally, I got to the point where if I wrote one more story about, a teenager who was testosterone poisoned with an attitude, I was going to have an aneurysm and I needed to do something different. And writing about robots was more fun.
Well, it's interesting. My Sebastian Thrun, and I don't know if that's the correct pronunciation.
I think it's Thrun.
Thrun, who developed the first Google car. And I just to tell you a quick story, when my son was an MD PhD student, got his MD PhD, which you get together at Wash U, we were going to give him an automobile as his graduation present. And he said to Dad and Mom, "I don't want one until I can get a car, a Google car." He still doesn't have a Google car, but he still dreams of an autonomous vehicle that he'll get to use. So an autonomous vehicle really makes life much easier for the user, especially if you think about driving around San Francisco or commuting from, for example, Palo Alto to San Francisco and back. When do you think we will actually get real autonomous vehicles, John?
It's a great question. So I've been telling people that if someone can send me an Uber, an autonomous Uber, to my home in San Francisco, and in the year 2025, if it takes me to dinner in Palo Alto, I'm paying for dinner. I think that a pure autonomous vehicle in an unstructured environment, not in a sort of constrained space like a campus or a downtown area, is going to be a really hard problem. There's going to be lots of approximations. I mean, for example, Tesla this year will have self-driving on freeways, and next year GM will have that. So the car will drive itself on a freeway, but you're still going to be responsible. It's not like it could drive without you in the car. So bits and pieces are coming quickly, but the real problem of just sort of calling a car with your cell phone and having it take you to where you want to go anywhere is not going to be solved anytime soon.
Now, you probably have ridden in this Tesla vehicle, I'm guessing. So let me just ask you, what will stop the non-quite autonomous driver, that is the driver of this, from just going off reading, doing computer work, et cetera, working on their smartphone,
Well, it'll be interesting to see how they design it. So right now, for example, Audi has a feature which is called Traffic Jam Assist, which is really a great feature. So the way that works is if you're in stop-and-go traffic on a freeway and your car is in a queue in a line following the car in front of it, the car will drive itself, and including following the car in front of you, up to the speed of 39 miles an hour. And it'll go back to zero and go up, you know, stop-and-go traffic. That's done. But the trick is you have to keep your hands on the wheel. If you take your hands off the wheel for more than 10 seconds, the car gives you an auditory warning, and it takes itself out of its autonomous mode.
So wow, it's hard to keep can you have long arms, or do you have to have both arms?
I mean, or fake rubber hands? Is that a possibility?
Yeah, but I mean, in other words, one of the real advantages, I mean, as I see it, when I think about this, I say, what's going to happen with real estate prices in the Bay Area? You think if you can go commute an hour with minimizing the cost of that commute, meaning someone else is doing the driving for you, so you'll be able to walk or do anything else you want to do while that drive is going on, you would think it would really change real estate prices.
Yeah, if we could have those machines that you could trust in all conditions, like, you know, heavy rain or snow, which they don't work in at the moment, by the way, then that kind of question of, you know, sort of the future of urban planning would be a real one. But it's also, isn't it interesting the way Americans think about transportation? I mean, when we think about solving this problem, we sort of think about flying cars. You know, we want our own personal system. And that sort of ignores the fact that they already have these devices that are pretty near autonomous and could be made autonomous really easily. They're called trains. And they carry a lot of people very efficiently. We don't think about those kinds of solutions as a society, which is interesting to me.
Now, there's a debate, obviously, and you characterize it beautifully in the book. And to me, it's interesting. Is this a real debate? Meaning, do people debate this, or is it just a debate because there are different values in the companies? So is there a debate on whether machines, and I guess Steve Hawken has weighed in on this, whether the computers will become artificial intelligent and really take us over, and in fact will have to fight for jobs, or will they in fact be extensions of us, that is intellectual augmentation? And you talk about the debate between different companies and the values. So maybe weigh in with Google versus Apple to start with.
Well, there's sort of two or three sort of vectors you're describing here. One of them is my dichotomy of AI versus IA, intelligence augmentations versus artificial intelligence. And that's a good sort of Google versus Apple question. And then you also mentioned, though, you know, the Elon Musk, Stephen Hawking, Nick Bostrom, et al. Concern that machine intelligence will increase in its capability so quickly that machines will be self-aware and perhaps more intelligent than humans and perhaps not have our best values in mind. Those are two separate questions. And, you know, let me first talk about Google versus Apple. And I think just first we could talk about Google versus Google, because inside Google they're both sort of questions alive. I mean, if you look at Google Search, that's probably the best IA tool ever created for humankind. I mean, we all have the equivalent of the Library of Alexandria at our fingertips, and it clearly is something that extends human intelligence. And then Google is also exploring things like self-driving cars that would, of course, displace perhaps huge numbers of human workers. Taxi cab drivers, bus drivers, et cetera, truck drivers. And so Google's, I wouldn't say it's at war with it itself, but it has its own sort of different values internally. On the other hand, Apple seems to be pretty committed. You know, this term is now with this new Sorkin Jobs movie gotten a lot of the phrase, a bicycle for the mind. That's what Steve Jobs defined a computer as. That's sort of the core of Apple's view of the world.
We're talking with John Markoff. We'll come back and talk about health with him. Machines of Love and Grace is the book.
It all started with a seed and a dream to grow sesame in the United States. Now, farmer Jimmy Kinder and others have thriving sesame fields in Oklahoma and other locations. Now, Harvest Stone is more passionate than ever about bringing you delicious and nutritious whole grain snacks. From our crispy organic bowl, original or cheese mixes, to our organic original sesame seed, tomato basil, and cracked pepper crackers, we're committed to using only the highest quality grains and seeds grown by farmers we know and trust, like Jimmy. After all, the best way to create snacks we feel good about is to start with ingredients we feel good about. Snack on something real. Check out HarvestStoneSnacks.com and be sure to request Harvest Stone products at a store near you. Harvest Stone has your snacking covered.
Do you have a great idea for a radio show but have no idea where to start? Or have you been hosting a podcast for a while and want to take it to the next level? If so, you need the Gab Radio Network. To host a show on the Gab Radio Network, all you need is your voice, and we'll handle the rest. From technical engineering to full-service audio production and much more. Every show on the Gab Radio Network can be heard on our station on the TuneIn Radio app. Plus, we put all of our shows on our satellite, which is accessed by over 5,500 stations. And here's the best part. You can host from anywhere you want. There are many means to connect to the Gab Radio Network remotely, and our staff of highly trained engineers and producers will make you sound like you're right here in studio. So, if you want to be on the Gab Radio Network, the same network that hosts the Small Business Advocate, Radio MD, and The Federalist, send an email right now to sales@gabradionetwork.com. That's sales@gabradionetwork.com.
Great party, huh, guys?
Yeah, it is. This is so great.
Uh-huh. I do say so myself. Hey, did you know that birthday parties actually help build confidence in kids?
Yeah, I did know that.
Did you know that giving kids less sugar before bedtime helps them sleep better?
Right, of course.
Yeah, I knew that. Did you know that strollers have the right of way on sidewalks?
Oh, yeah, I knew that.
Yeah, that's true. Did you know that friendly kids statistically have more friends?
Everyone knows that.
Oh, yeah?
It's pretty obvious.
Yeah, so obvious. Hey, guys, did you know that most people think they're using the right car seat for their kid, but they're not?
I didn't know that.
Think I knew that.
No, you didn't.
Parents who really know it all know for sure that their child is in the right car seat at the right age and size. Visit safercar.gov/the right seat to make sure your child is protected. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
It's illegal and dangerous for teens to drink any alcohol and then drive. Still, 1 in 10 high school teens drank and got behind the wheel of a car in 2011. If you're a parent, be aware that when teens drink, it's usually to get drunk. Teenagers can't legally buy alcohol, but many get it from their homes or the homes of their friends. Drinking and driving is never okay. Make sure your teenager has a safe way to get home in case they're out with a teen driver who's been drinking. Put this in a parent-teen driving agreement, which should also include wearing a seatbelt and following their state's graduated driver licensing laws every time they're behind the wheel. Find a sample at www.cdc.gov/parentsarethekey. Parents really are the key to safe teen driving. Learn more at www.cdc.gov/vital signs.
And now, back to you, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, starring Dr. Michael Roizen.
And this is Dr. Mike. You're listening to Machines of Loving Grace author John Markoff, who we're fortunate enough to have to talk with us today. It's really just a fascinating, wonderful book he's written on the history of Silicon Valley and the battle for whether AI or IA, as he puts it, that is artificial intelligence with machines taking over, or intellectual augmentation with us using machines to be able to be more productive, wins. The Quest for Common Ground is the subtitle, Between Humans and Robots. John Markoff, M-A-R-K-O-F-F, Machines of Loving Grace. It's a wonderful read, as you would expect from such a experienced writer. Let me go and go to a different area, John, if you will, but something that you probably have more insight into than others. I'm at ShareCare over the weekend. ShareCare is a company that hopes to develop and is developing frictionless smartphone devices, so it measures your stress through voice apps frictionlessly. It does, obviously, it can accumulate with both the Android and the Apple Health apps to look at sleep and look at physical activity patterns, and hopefully we'll have other things such as food portion size and sugar levels and inflammation levels over time. But will those be enough? Will frictionless collection of the data as we're gradually accumulating on our smartphone be enough to motivate us to change behavior? Let me set it up for you and for the listeners that probably know it somewhat. That is, 97% of us enter Medicare with a chronic disease, either unmanaged or untreated totally, and that's what drives that influx of chronic disease, is what drives our healthcare costs, decreases our ability to pay for social programs, new job development, research, even defense. We know how to cure that or how to prevent that. If you get to six normals, in the nurses' health studies, either young nurses or old nurses, if you get in there in the Swedish men's study, that is, get normal blood pressure, normal LDL cholesterol, normal waist for height, normal fasting blood sugar, no cotinine or tobacco end products, and manage stress, you have a 83 to 90% chance, depending on the study, of preventing chronic disease over a 18 to 28 year period. So we know how to get there, but we aren't there. Will the change in smartphone and whether you call it IA or AI in the phone be able to motivate us to get healthier?
Boy, well, let's just talk about one of them, because it's really fascinating to me. I think we're kind of in the hand crank era of the kinds of applications you're talking about. I mean, they're there. For example, I tend to follow how much I move in a day with my smartphone, which is a really great thing to have, but it's kind of manual, and it doesn't really speak directly to motivation. I mean, if I'm motivated, it's a great tool to help me see that I'm moving enough, but the tool by itself doesn't motivate me, and I'm not sure, I think that's sort of slightly above my pay grade, solving that motivation question. What makes people sort of commit to those kinds of goals, and let's look at the one of them, not be sedentary. Maybe a second generation of technology would actually give us a companion who would sort of watch all of these indicators you get from the smartphone and sort of interpret them for us, and that might make it easier to be highly motivated to do the right thing. And I think that's coming over the next half decade. So I can see things moving in the right direction.
What we've done at the Cleveland Clinic, I'm Chief Wellness Officer and Chair of the Wellness Institute there, is by having large enough differential in insurance premiums for obtaining or not obtaining the five normals, we're able to motivate, in fact, 95% of people who had five or six normals in 2008 still have it, and 63.8% of those who didn't are now either on the way or have achieved that. So we've used financial incentives with that, as well as changing the environment, having programs, etc. But there still is something missing for obviously we have not got a social strategy, in fact, for the federal government to pay people to stay well the way essentially we do with our own employees and their dependents.
You know, there's a great experiment at Stanford. People love lotteries, and now that we're all instrumented with our smartphones, the folks at Stanford who are concerned about the wellness of the students and the staff have created a system that basically, if you're willing to park a little farther away and walk farther to get to your classroom, which helps with congestion and things like that. That was why they did it. But it turns out that they can automatically enter you in a lottery. And actually, they've got all this kind of social game stuff, but the lottery is the one that's interesting to me. So that every day, the people who park far away are entered into the lottery, and one of them wins a fair amount of, you know, like $50 or something like that, which turns out to be highly motivating. And I think that's a great tool to get people to do simple things like that.
Let me switch gears now and go into elder care and robots. Tell us the latest and what's going to happen. You allude to it in the book. And by the way, if you're interested in learning anything about the development of Silicon Valley and robots and machines, this is a great, not a great book, this is almost a must book, Machines of Loving Grace by John Markoff. But John, now tell me more about the robots and the elder care.
What really surprised me, or that I sort of became more aware of in doing my research, is if you look at the entire advanced world, if you look at Asia, including China, particularly Japan and Korea, Europe, and even the United States, we're aging at a remarkable rate. And there is a case to be made that we're going to actually need robots to help with elder care. And that robotic technology, you know, it's not quite there. I mean, you can do some things with robots, but to actually do the kinds of physically intensive and dexterous things and delicate things that human caregivers do right now, we don't have the robots to do that. Over the next decade or two, I think that we might move toward them. And, you know, there are fun ways to look at this, like the movie Robot and Frank, which portrayed a person with early stage Alzheimer's who was given a futuristic robot to help them. But I think it's something that we need to discuss. I think you could use it you could use this technology in bad ways that would isolate people, or you could use the technology to help create communities.
And your bet?
And I'm sorry?
Your bet on which happens
first. My bet is that these things are going to, by and large, help us. I think that as you roll this technology out, it will make the quality of life for elders better.
We've been talking with John Markoff, the book Machines of Loving Grace. It's a magnificent book, and as you've heard, he has a great depth of knowledge, and it's in the book. Get it? Machines of Loving Grace. We'll be right back on You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.